Diving into the book bag today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today, we're going to spend our time talking about books we have read or have in prospect on Scribble. I just noticed that this is program number 268, and that's not counting about 11 fund drive programs.
I mean, who would believe it?
How did the time elapse?
I don't know.
I thought this was going to be a part-time deal.
My question is, where are all these people who have everything to do with writing come from?
I mean, the Quad Cities.
Is there anybody in the Quad Cities who does not write?
We have run into more authors and really good ones, too. It's authors, poets. Of course, we've talked to editors.
Publishers?
Yeah, all kinds of people. That the Internet may be the great enemy, but books are not dead.
They are not. In fact, what I've been reading lately is that they are coming back. People are less and less using, you know, their tablets for reading and going back to books which they can open.
Well, I'm all for that, and we've opened a few books. We're going to talk about them today, and the man who seems to spend his whole life reading can start out.
Okay. Well, the book bag, I must say, is overflowing. We've been fairly lax, and people have reminded me, we've been fairly lax about mentioning books. We tend to overdo our time with guests who turn out to be so interesting we can't turn them off.
I was going to say, it's not our fault. If we just had guests who were dull, it would be simple.
At any rate, our guests turn out to be incredibly interesting for the most part.
Yeah.
But so are some books that are waiting to be mentioned. And what we're going to do today then is simply go through as many books as we have time to do in our half hour. I want to begin with a book that Don Erickson gave me about 6 months ago that changed my whole way of looking at things. It's a book called The Moth Snowstorm on Nature and Joy by Michael McCarthy. Michael McCarthy is an Englishman. He's a longtime environmental columnist for British papers and magazines. And his subject is our relationship with nature, which is, of course, a biggie these days. All sorts of books have been coming out about how things are going extinct, how animals are in trouble, plants and wildlife of all kinds. He's not so concerned, however, with actual extinction as he is with the diminishing number of animals, plants, insects in the world. The Moth Snowstorm refers to you will remember, I mean, because we're both old enough, you remember the old days back in the 40s, for instance, when standing around under a streetlight talking with your buddies at night, overhead the streetlight was showered with hundreds and hundreds of moths fluttering all over.
Now, I'll do you one better. When I first came up to the Quad Cities in 46, I went downtown one time, and as I neared the downtown and was walking, I thought, boy, there are a lot of little these mayflies flying around.
Oh, yeah.
And then pretty soon, it got so thick, it affected visibility, and underfoot, it was slippery. There were so many of them.
Streetcars used to slip on them.
Oh, I've never seen so many in my life.
And it, you know, in the 40s, during World War II, I can remember the speed limit for cars was 35 miles an hour. And even as you drove down from one town to another out in the country, your headlights would be hundreds and hundreds of moths. In fact, you probably remember, as I do, scraping off your windshield after a trip because of all the insects that stuck there.
Yeah, if I'd had a car, I'd remember that.
Well, they're gone.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've been noticing that and thinking a little bit about it, but McCarthy really, really does a good job of talking about why this is important. I can remember, for instance, when we first came in 1960, moved into our house in the spring of 61, for years I can remember on a June evenings when it's nice and warm and a little moist, hundreds and hundreds of lightning bugs over the place. They began to disappear, and I think this year for the first time, I did not see a single lightning bug.
I was fortunate to see some.
But not the hundreds and hundreds that there used to be.
I used to drive Bernadette out into the country, onto the fields, where you'd see a carpet of lightning bugs all around. It was just a beautiful, beautiful sight. But you don't see them in
those
numbers.
We used to collect them and put them in jars and make lanterns for under the bedclothes at night.
That's true. That's true.
At any rate, it turns out that in the past 40 years or so, about half the insect population in the world has disappeared.
Yeah.
Not individual species, but just the number of insects. Mm-hmm. Why is that important? Not just because I like to look at lightning bugs, but because about 40% of what we eat is dependent on pollination from those insects.
Yeah.
And orchardists are having increasingly difficult times finding insects to pollinate their crops.
Over in China, they're having to hand pollinate some trees. And I remember reading about a group of people in this village. They would go out every day and hand pollinate all the little blossoms. Can you imagine if we had to do that for corn and everything else, all kinds of plants? I say that thinking corn has to be pollinated, but
that corn is pollinated by the wind.
Yeah.
Well, but apples, not.
Who's the author of this book?
Michael McCarthy is his name.
Mm-hmm.
But what he is trying to do in this book is to somehow reconnect. One more fact. The sparrows, the house sparrows that got introduced from England that are annoying all of us because half the feeders are taken up with house sparrows. And,
tell me about it. Yeah.
Okay. It turns out that very few cities in England have any house sparrows at all anymore. They used to flock all over the place, and he and a friend of his went to a couple of big cities, including London. No house sparrows anymore.
That's
birds
amazing.
Are disappearing, too.
Yeah.
I saw my first red-headed woodpecker yesterday in 10 years. You know, we used to be all over our backyards. You know, the orchestra of birds that I could hear in the morning in our backyard is now a chamber music.
So does he propose any solution, or is this just a sound of alarm?
Well, we better do so. His interest is that why do we need to reconnect to nature? I mean, why is that important? All sorts of recent studies have shown that being out in nature has a healing property to it. In Baltimore, someplace, they cut down a whole street full of street trees, and the illness rate in that block went up.
Yeah.
Simply because we lost contact. His claim is, which is, I think, also interesting, and it's an interesting argument, that since the age of Christianity is ending, we need some source and some resource to connect back to mystery and joy and wonder and love. And so we had better do it because the church is no longer going to be able to do that very long.
Yeah, it is serious. Edward O. Wilson identified 5 minuscule insects that if they disappear, all of life goes. All of life goes, at least a higher life. Bacteria will do just fine.
Part of it's insecticides. Part of it is the fact that, you know, even something as insignificant as the the fields now that farmers plant are planted corner to corner instead of a rounded off. And so there's less and less space for these insects. But it's mainly insecticides.
Yeah.
We don't use insecticides on our yard at all, but of course they come from everywhere else. Anyway, I used to be able to go out after a storm when I was a kid and pick up salamanders in ditches. Mm-hmm. I used to find snakes on our front steps sunning themselves in the morning, getting warm so that they could go about their... Haven't seen those for years. You know, nature is under our very eyes disappearing.
What's the name of that book again?
The Moth Snowstorm.
Okay, by McCarthy.
Michael McCarthy.
Let me just mention a book here that I have not read, I just bought. I have been reluctant to look at any book that claims to follow the Millennium Trilogy by Stieg Larsson, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Right.
That trilogy was stunning, ferocious and stunning. But now people claim that this one, The Girl in the Spider's Web by David Lagercrantz.
He's a relative, isn't he? I mean,
somehow
he's connected to the original author.
Yeah, and that's been kind of a messy thing.
Yeah.
Because...
the rights to the book.
Yeah, right. Larsson lived with a woman whom he should have married. And when he died, his family just shut her out completely. She tried writing a book, and it had minimal success. But I think this fellow is a relative. But they say he's done a very good job. And I'm interested in reading the book, and you can read it with me. It's called The Girl in the Spider's Web. It's out in paperback now and sells for about $17, but it looks interesting. So that's not a review. That's a plug for something that I'm going to be reading and you might be interested in, too, if you were a fan of Stieg Larsson.
I was a fan of Stieg Larsson.
Oh, yeah. It's hard not to be, isn't it?
Well,
by the way, the movie, The Girl and the Dragon Tattoo, we have made a version in this country.
Right.
It's good. But you ought to see the Swedish trilogy.
Right.
Boy, is that good.
Yeah, that's what I've seen neither, but that's what I've heard.
Oh, yeah. That does justice to the original trilogy. Okay. Back to the boss.
The next book I want to recommend is the strangest book I have read in probably 5 or 6 years, maybe even a lot longer than that. It's a book called Mutant Message Down Under. Mutant Message Down Under by Marlo Morgan. It was given to me by Bev Wilt, and I should have noticed that glint in her eyes when she gave it to me that something was up. This is a book when it first came out. It's about 10 years old. When it first came out, first of all, it got to be one of those books that everybody should be reading, particularly young people. It also was a book that every time Marlo Morgan went for a book signing or did a program on the book, she was besieged with supporters who supported the book and with attackers who claimed that the whole thing is bogus and fictional and she's doing a disservice to Australian culture and so forth. Now, here's the story. Marlo Morgan, the author, says this is a work of fiction because I can't remember exactly what everybody said, so I'm turning it into a fiction. But anyway, she says, on the other hand, it did happen. Marlo Morgan is a medically trained person who has done workshops around the world for health organizations, who was invited to Australia to help the Flying Doctors develop a program for them. And while she was there, she undertook to develop a program for Aborigine adolescent kids in town who were driftless and not doing anything, and really did got them going and got them set on the straight path. In return for which, she claims, she was invited to an Aborigine party in her honor. And an Aborigine who spoke English picked her up in a Jeep from her hotel in Sydney and drove her many, many miles out, and she assumed she was going to have a luncheon. Instead, she gets to a little open shed. There are six Aborigine people there of all various ages, and immediately they strip her of her dress, put on a kind of shift material. She doesn't know what it's made out of, and she turns around to see them burning her purse, her passport, her rings, her jewelry, and her camera. Okay, then they start walking, and she thinks, "Well, you know, where are we going? You know, this can't be too far." And it turns out, before she knows it, she has gone on a roundabout, a walkabout, as the Aborigines call it, for 2,000 miles over 4 months until she reaches the west coast of Australia and civilization. Meanwhile, nobody knows where she is or what she's doing. They don't speak much English. They don't want to tell her much because their culture is so private. But as she walks for 4 months, gradually, she comes to learn more and more about her Aborigine culture and what their beliefs are. They believe, this book says, in divine oneness. There is nothing like accident in the world. Everything is carefully planned out. Everything is interrelated. They don't worry about tomorrow because tomorrow is provided for. For example, they take along no food. They take along no water to carry. Meanwhile, she's barefoot. She's got blisters. She's never walked before. Could this really happen? I don't know. It always turns out that that sometime during the day, food magically appears, a plant. There are other things. These people don't talk at all. It turns out they're communicating by telepathy over as long as 20 miles. One day, one of the Aborigines is out, and he kills a kangaroo, and he wants permission from the tribe to cut the tail off because it's so heavy to bring back to camp. And they give him permission by telepathy. It is really a fascinating, interesting read, but the author, Marlo Morgan, is so coy, and there are parts, you know. So I said, I'm going to figure this out. You know, do I really believe this or not? And I can't tell you today. So I am hoping that somebody out there will read it and tell me what you think. It is the strangest book.
It's title again.
Mutant Message Down Under. It turns out the Aborigines, the word for her is mutant because she's departed from true life.
Oh.
She, you know, for instance, she makes gravy one day because she wants them to, you know, have a traditional Thanksgiving dinner. So they're little pieces of meat. She stirs up a gravy out of some sort of herbs and stuff. And they said, this is just like you white people, right? I mean, you cover over really perfectly good food with junky stuff, right? Well, and we do, right?
Yeah.
So this is an indictment of our way of doing things and a wonderful exploration, maybe total science fiction and fantasy, of the Aborigine way of life. So she does have Aborigine supporters who say this is the first time anybody has shown us absolute Aborigine culture apart from the Aborigines who are drunk in the cities. Others who say this is absolute BS.
Yeah.
And she's doing an incredible disservice to Australian culture.
Well, you can join the fight by reading the book.
It is. It's not a long read, but it just drives me crazy.
Now, you may have heard of this book. I hope you have. Furious Hours. Subtitle is Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee by Casey Sepp, C-E-P. Harper Lee helped, what's his name? Shoot. My memory's gone now. Somewhere in this book is this picture. But she helped write a famous book, Truman Capote,
right.
That was it.
Yes.
And then it turns out some people think that Harper did more of the work in Cold Blood than Truman did. She was a more serious cooperator than just someone assisting him. And Truman Capote, of course, would shut everybody else out of taking credit for the book. But then she decided to look into a curious case back in Alabama. There was a minister, a black minister, Reverend Willie Maxwell, who'd been a veteran, came back, decided to become a preacher. But he had a bad habit of marrying women, insuring them, and then apparently killing them. At least that was the charge. And not just them. His stepdaughter died. He was accused of insuring her. And in fact, he did. All these people who died were heavily insured, and he did fine, I guess, until he needed another insurance payment. Now, he was brought to trial, but there was a white lawyer named Tom Radney who got him off every time until finally at, I think it was, as I recall, was at a funeral of one of these people, a relative shot Willie Maxwell, killed him right there. So he was brought to trial, and Radney defended him and got him off. But along the way, we read a lot about Harper Lee, about why she never finished the book that she was going to call The Reverend, which was about Willie Maxwell.
Okay.
And his really terrible record and the things he had done, but she didn't finish it. So what Sepp did, he was able to get hold of her papers. He went in and examined the trial. Part of the book is about Willie Maxwell and what happened, and the other is a part about speculation about Harper Lee, why she never really was able to finish the book. It's an interesting story, a very involving book, and I would recommend it to anyone who wants to delve into this and know a little bit more about Harper Lee. Furious Hours by Casey Sepp, C-E-P.
My third recommendation is a book called Pilgrimage to Eternity. The subtitle, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. The author is Timothy Egan, who will be familiar to anybody who reads the New York Times. He's a famous columnist for them. And he's a lapsed Catholic from Washington State. And he decides to see what kind of faith, what kind of belief he has left, if any. And to do this, he decides to take a pilgrimage that turns out is well marked out. It's not as famous as the one to Santiago in Spain, but it's one that still is marked, and you still get stamped along the way. It's the Via Francigena, down through France, across the Alps to Italy, and eventually to Rome. There are still a few pilgrims that take it, not hordes, but he does meet a few along the way. He decides to take this trip and along the way figure out what he really believes. He is not walking the whole way. It's 1,000 miles, and he only has like a month. But he agrees to go by any way except by plane. So he takes trains, he takes buses, he rents a car. A good part of it, he walks. His daughter comes over to visit him, his wife comes over for a week, and so he walks part of it together. But what is interesting to me is that along the way, this is a part of Europe that I'm totally unfamiliar with. It turns out that all kinds of famous, important people, down to Oscar Wilde, played an important part in one or another towns along the way. So it is loaded with really interesting religious history, civil history, and nature. Famous churches are along the way. The one in which a whole how many, a couple thousand Huguenots were huddled at a church for safety, and they were all burned to death by the Christian church. The church doesn't come out terribly well here. The ringer in the whole thing is that he hopes at the end, given the fact that he's a famous columnist, that he can get a visit with Pope Francis. There turns out there's incredible rigmarole that you have to go through to do that. You have to get a statement from your bishop, and you have to get a statement from this and that, and so forth. So he has no idea whether he's really going to do that or not. But he goes through all these churches. He visits all the relics, the finger bone of so-and-so, and the ear of somebody else. And every once in a while, he talks a little bit about his faith. And I don't want to tell you how his faith turns out, but it is really an interesting read.
Okay.
And you get, including this statement, it turns out that Oscar Wilde, as he was in his final illness, dabbled back with the church.
Mm-hmm.
And one of Oscar Wilde's famous statements to me is Lutheran theology in a nutshell. Oscar Wilde didn't intend it to be Lutheran theology, but it is. Here's the statement. Every saint has a past. Every sinner has a future.
Very good.
Isn't that good?
Yeah, that is.
It is a great read.
And the book is?
Pilgrimage to Eternity.
Okay. Just briefly, a book I talked about with Father Bud Grant some time ago, The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis, put out about 4 years ago. I came to it lately. If you would really like to know something about the whole business of the fracas that's going on now, about Pope Francis and change has been a steady part of the church. You don't notice it because it takes centuries for it to eventuate. But his chapters are the coming and going of Latin, the coming and going of monarchy, the coming and going of anti-Semitism, the coming and going of natural law, and the coming and going of confession. And what he talks about in this book is really worth your attention, particularly if you're a Catholic and you're worried about change in the church. But I should warn you, the book is out of print. But you can, however, go to Amazon and find a copy. I prefer not to go to Amazon, but in this case, I wanted to get another copy, and that was my only chance. So if you are interested in digging into this, Gary Wills writes like a dream. He is clear, easy to read. The man is an assiduous researcher. He has dug very carefully into all these things, and if you want to search for that book, I think you'll find it worthwhile. The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis by Gary Wills. That'll do it. Boy, time flies.
Wow.
Talking about books, yeah, we've barely
got
in.
I've got 10 more to go through.
Well, there are other programs, so hang on to them, and we hope you'll come back for those other programs. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. We'll see you next time on Scribbles.